There's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. Producer Tom, push that button.
What's trending at home?
So the new U.S. attorney in Seattle, his name is Brian Moran. He had some very choice words for the city of Seattle and all of the so-called leaders who are thinking about moving forward with a heroin injection site, whether that means a physical location or a mobile heroin injection site. His words, really simple. Don't go there. That is a bridge too far. We did two interviews with the Seattle Times and KUOW, and he said, I've talked to Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes about it. I said, don't go there, Pete. Don't go there. If they did, the Trump administration will sue. They've already shown an interest in suing. They've sued the city of Philadelphia. So they will absolutely sue the city of Seattle. And they'll sue under the Controlled Substances Act. Because basically, you can't create a crack house. That's basically what it says. And that's exactly what would happen if you created a heroin injection site. You're not allowed to manage a place that enables the use of illicit drugs. And that's exactly what this would do. Now, Mayor Jenny Durkan, herself a former U.S. attorney, she's upset. She's upset that she has to follow the law. Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes is upset. He's quoted as saying the administration's position continues to be disappointing because these are sites where medical professionals can meaningfully engage with people facing addictions, offering supervision, but also treatment. None of what he just said there is true. None of what he said there is true. You are not meaningfully engaging people who are desperate for a drug that completely alters their reality. They're not paying attention to you when they're shooting up. They're not understanding you after they've shot up. This whole idea that this can offer treatment, offering treatment and being successful in getting treatment, two different things. If there was data to back up the fact that this actually helps people get off of heroin, they would be leading with that, but they don't. And it's interesting because when they first started to talk about this issue here in Seattle, they would say, oh, this is going to get people who are deeply addicted to heroin into treatment. They don't have any data to back that up. So then they started to change the conversation. This is about harm reduction. This is about harm reduction. This is a place for people to go so they won't overdose, so they won't spread disease by sharing needles. And there's absolute truth to that, right? I mean, I know they weirdly called this a heroin injection site, actually a safe injection site when it's not safe. In fact, it's not safe. That's why they have medical professionals there. And it is absolutely true that that medical professional will be able to intervene if someone is overdosing. And giving them clean needles means, yes, they're not sharing needles. That's good. That's harm reduction. You know what else is harm reduction? You know what also prevents someone from dying of an overdose or contracting a disease from a used needle? Treatment. Treatment that gets them off this deadly disease, this deadly drug, giving them this deadly disease. Treatment. But they're not interested in treatment, are they? They don't really talk about treatment, do they? They talk about harm reduction because they've given up. Jenny Durkan, the Seattle City Council, the King County Council, Dow Constantine, King County Executive, they've given up. They're not talking about treatment. They're talking about mitigation. That's a problem. That's a huge problem. And kudos to Brian Moran for stepping up and making it very clear that he'll sue. Now, the truth is, it doesn't really matter because the city of Seattle, they're going to move forward anyway. They don't care about no stupid lawsuit. They love to flaunt their lawlessness, which is funny because they get mad when you don't follow the law. They'll threaten to go after sheriffs who don't want to enforce an unconstitutional anti-gun provision. But when the law actually applies to them, they're like, eh, I don't follow it. State Senator Mike Patton, he had an amendment to a Senate budget bill. And in this amendment, it would prohibit state funds from being used for safe injection sites or heroin injection sites all across the state of Washington. Guess what? It actually passed. It actually passed. Senator Patton, the Republican, said, you know what? It's time for us to completely stay out of the heroin business.
This amendment just makes sure that we, the state, stay out of any use for heroin injection sites, which, of course, allows for the deadly substance of heroin is actually facilitated in these sites.
I am a little surprised that this passed, but you know what? This does give us some semblance of hope for what's going on in Olympia. They've heard from you guys. Democrats have heard from you that you don't want heroin injection sites popping up in your neighborhood. In fact, even proponents don't want it popping up in their neighborhood. My favorite part, Lisa Herbold is a Seattle City Councilwoman. She represents West Seattle. And she was asked at a recent Speak Out Seattle event whether or not she supports heroin injection sites. She goes, I support them, just not West Seattle. I don't want them here. That's kind of weird, isn't it? Why don't you want it there? Because you know what it brings to your neighborhood. And I suppose it's okay to put it in, say, downtown Seattle because you don't really care about that neighborhood anymore. In fact, a King County judge is going to be on the show at 5:30 to talk about what's been going on outside of his courtroom. You don't normally hear from courts. You don't normally hear from judges on issues like this, but he has decided to speak up because it's incredibly important. So he's going to stop by at 5:30. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending on the campaign trail?
So Joe Biden is not quite yet on the campaign trail, but he's clearly going there. He's running for president. He's going to announce soon. Something he didn't want to have to deal with right before announcement is this idea that he's a close talker and have made women feel uncomfortable. In fact, because he is about to announce is why we're having this conversation, because it's leaking from probably the Bernie Sanders campaign. That's been the speculation from some news analysts, that Bernie Sanders' campaign is behind all of this coming forward. Certainly one of the women who came forward, the first one who came forward, she was a Bernie supporter back in the last election. And so now Joe Biden is responding in a horrible video that was done on a cell phone. They didn't even shoot it horizontally. They shot it vertically. And he's basically saying, you know what? I never meant to make anyone uncomfortable. Some of this has to do with a changing viewpoint, I suppose, on how we interact with individuals.
I've never thought of politics as cold and antiseptic. I've always thought about connecting with people. As I said, shaking hands, hands on the shoulder, a hug, encouragement. And now it's all about taking selfies together. Social norms have begun to change. They've shifted. And the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset. And I get it. I get it. I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility. My responsibility, and I'll meet it. But I'll always believe governing, quite frankly, life for that matter, is about connecting.
And kissing people on necks.
Connecting with people.
Sniffing
their hair. That will change. But I will be more mindful and respectful of people's personal space. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
That definitely is a good thing, because we don't like close talkers. Now, I don't think he did anything wrong here. I don't think he needs to apologize in any meaningful way. But it is 2019. He is trying to become the leader of the new woke Democratic Party. Not everyone actually supports this response. I thought the response was fine and appropriate. But former senior Hillary Clinton aide, who's currently a CNN political contributor, her name is Jess McIntosh. Oh, she is not buying this apology.
He's got to take responsibility. I think that's what women are waiting to hear him do.
Just real quick, and I suppose I'll be mansplaining a second, but women aren't waiting for anything. Jess McIntosh, you don't speak for all women. You speak for yourself, and maybe you speak for a small group of people who you personally know. And maybe in that world, they're waiting for something else. Women are not waiting for anything, no more than men are waiting for anything. Okay? Women all don't think in a singular way. Women don't all hold your positions on this particular issue. So speak for yourself, which is what you're paid to do, not speak on behalf of other people who you certainly don't represent.
This excuse that societal norms have changed just doesn't wash. I mean, that sort of paternal behavior towards women in a professional setting has been making women feel uncomfortable for generations. The only societal norm that has changed is that men seem to be taking us seriously when we complain about it now. So the idea that this behavior used to be okay and now it's not just really doesn't wash.
Actually, yes, it does wash. That behavior was historically okay, and that's changed. Now, I can't imagine Jess McIntosh or anyone in her position is going to deny this cultural shift that we have been seeing. It's been led by people like Jess McIntosh. It's been led by the left, the political left, by progressives. They are pushing a version of affirmative consent that is so extreme, you could be called a rapist if, at a date, at a movie theater, you lean in and you kiss your date without saying, may I kiss you? Yes, cool. Please sign this contract here and let's go get a third party to witness it. Let's get a notary Republican here so I can cover myself. They're clearly trying to change society. Now, I'm okay with some of the changes. I'm not with some other ones. Some I don't care about at all. Mostly because I'm alone and unloved, and so I'm never going to have this kind of physical touch at all.
Here we go.
And it's just, I just want someone
here
to swipe
comes.
Right.
Here come the waterworks.
That's all I want sometimes is
where's
just someone to say,
box?
You know what, Jason? I'm into you.
Where's
and
the
I want to date
bond?
You.
And the ice
and maybe
cream.
I, you know, it'll just be a few dates and then I'll ghost
boy.
You. Or maybe
losing
I won't even go to the date.
I'm just going to
ghost you before we actually go.
Oh,
so,
man.
But let's be clear. Things have changed. Joe Biden's behavior is appropriate, or at least was appropriate. Now you're judging it by 2019 standards. That's not fair. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show. It would be a mistake if you don't have the KTTH app on your phone. It would be a huge mistake not to download the app. Now, you can download the KTTH app in your app store, or just text the keyword app to the number 1-800-465-8770. I'll go ahead and send you a link so you can download it whether you have an iPhone or an Android. Text the keyword app to 1-800-465-8770. That's the number or tax resolution hotline. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Big picture.
So Boeing, through their CEO, is apologizing to the families of those who died in the two 737 MAX airplane crashes in the last year. One, of course, was Ethiopian Air. One, of course, was Lion Air. The video was posted on Twitter of the apology. The CEO's name is Dennis Muhlenberg. And he put this out there because we got this preliminary report today that says it was malfunctioning. This flight was malfunctioning because of the software that essentially forced the plane's nose down in an inappropriate way, in an unexpected way, and it overwhelmed the pilots.
As pilots have told us, erroneous activation of the MCAS function can add to what is already a high workload environment. It's our responsibility to eliminate this risk. We own it, and we know how to do it.
So, you know, it's interesting because they're saying they own the mistake and they know how to fix it. Why did you not test this out and identify it before two planes crashed? I think that is a reasonable question. And for you to tell us now that you're not only do you own the problems, but you're going to do something about it. Well, you didn't put out the software correctly the first time. Why should we trust that you're going to put out a fix in a meaningful way that actually does do what it's supposed to do? Now, they say they've been working on this software fix and they will train pilots on the new technology.
But with the release of the preliminary report of the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 accident investigation, it's apparent that in both flights, the maneuvering characteristics augmentation system, known as MCAS, activated in response to erroneous angle of attack information.
I'm in a weird place when it comes to Boeing, and I think most of us are, or certainly could sympathize with the problem here. We want safe airplanes, period. We want safe airplanes. We want pilots to be able to get into a plane, fly that plane, and have a basic understanding of the technology. And even though President Trump took a lot of criticism for this comment, he's right. Sometimes the technology is so advanced or so crazy that a human being isn't smart enough to actually fly our planes. And you shouldn't have to be a brain surgeon to be able to fly some of these planes. It should be just a little bit easier. I want someone to be an expert at it. I want someone to train and study and get a lot of hours behind the flights. But it shouldn't be impossible for a human being to understand. And it turns out his line that all the progressives on Twitter and CNN laughed at him, he's basically right. That it's some kind of software that overwhelms a crew that was already trained in dealing with this. So I want Boeing to come out and put out a product that doesn't kill. I also am very sensitive to the fact that Boeing is a Washington employer. Boeing brings in millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars into our economy. It employs thousands of Washingtonians. I mean, Everett would be devastated without Boeing. Let's be clear. This general region would take a significant hit when Boeing takes a significant hit. The question is whether or not they can man this storm, right? Whether or not they're going to be able to survive the fallout, especially after lawsuits come, and especially after airliners or companies say, we're going to go with Airbus instead. We're not going to go with a Boeing plane. That's problematic. And it's certainly problematic if the U.S. government starts to rethink their relationship with Boeing. This could have a very negative effect on this region, and I don't want it to be there. And so ultimately, I'm of the position that, you know, it's in the best interest of this region and Boeing to put out a really good quality product. I don't know how confident I would feel if all of a sudden you told me, oh, we're going to put you on a 737 MAX to L.A. or Vegas or to wherever it is you're going. Oh, it's fine. Now, don't worry. We put in the new software. I feel, as someone who's already a very nervous flyer, I don't know if I would want to go on that plane. Now, of course, think about it in a rational way. Two plane crashes out of many actual flights that were all successful. But still, I just, to me, there's something unreasonable about being in a plane that's flying at 35,000 feet in the air to begin with. And I wonder how they're going to be able to weather the storm. But we'll see. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? National.
So finally, the National Safety Council is kicking off their Distracted Driving Awareness Month with an ask that is so absurd, I almost don't want to play the audio for fear that it will cause you to angrily grab the wheel of your car and then very quickly turn into oncoming traffic, just so you don't have to get through this stupid ask. And so I'm warning you, please don't react that way. They want you to basically put your cell phones in the trunk of your car so that you stop using your phone and contributing to distracted driving. The National Safety Council Vice President Kelly Nantle spoke with Chris Sullivan from our sister station, Cairo Radio, saying, distracted driving is really dangerous and we need to take action now.
In my perfect world, yes, the phone would be out of the car. We survived for many decades without phones in our car. I think we can do it again, quite easily. It's just a matter of discipline and taking the phone out of your reach.
Uh-huh. Just real quick, it's not a matter of discipline, with all due respect, lady. I don't need you to tell me about discipline. Number one, we've seen books written and studies conducted about the addictive nature of cell phones. They are addictive. And so when you're addicted to something, you can't just simply say, well, I'm gonna have the wherewithal and fortitude to not engage. That's not how addiction works. Okay? Number two, with all due respect, I am capable of safely using a phone while being in my vehicle. Take, for example, me being in a car, stuck at a red light, stuck on Mercer, no one is moving. I can send a quick text to someone telling them I'm going to be late to the movie. If I'm sitting in my car with the keys in the ignition, the car running, and I am stopped at a bridge that is up so that a boat can go by, I can safely use my phone and send out a tweet if I wanted to. Snarky tweet and all. Let us not pretend that doing something like that is very clearly safe is the equivalent of flying down I-5, not realizing you're very close to JBLM and it's going to start getting all congested. You're speeding and you're Snapchatting the entire... Let's not pretend the two are equal. Let's not pretend that at all. Part of the issue here is a bunch of older people who didn't grow up with this kind of technology, so they're not as comfortable as younger people using this technology. And they assume that people cannot do two things at once. No one is taking the position that you should be able to just speed down a freeway while tweeting. No one's taking that position. We're taking a much saner position of, yeah, when you're not driving fast in your car, you're not driving at all, you can use your phone. I've been in conversations in cars that get very animated and we debate and we talk. I've yelled at the radio multiple times. Multiple times. Sometimes at the host. Sometimes, oh, Rush, you're killing it right now. Oh, Saul Spady, you're killing it right now. And you know what hasn't happened? Any crashes. You know what it's just as dangerous as? Using a phone, which means not very dangerous at all. I just don't buy into the nanny state mentality here. Stay out of my car. Stay out of my car, and I'll act in an appropriate way. How about that?
You're such a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, shut up. They're bugging this studio right now.
They're listening
to everything. And you know what? On the way home, it's possible that they heard my broadcast and they'll take me out.
Yeah, and Bush did 9/11 too. No, we know, Jason. Save us, you star of InfoWars, Jason Rantz.
Okay. Welcome back to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. The topic of whether or not Seattle is dying has focused a large bit of attention in downtown Seattle, and with good reason. On the streets, you'll often see people shooting up or even harassing people who are just walking by. And it's particularly disturbing and perhaps a little bit ironic that it's happening right outside of the King County Courthouse. It's gotten so bad that people who work at the court, plus jurors, they don't feel safe in the area. Joining me on the line to discuss the issue is King County Superior Court Judge Sean O'Donnell. Judge, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
So a quick review of your Twitter feed sees this reality of the situation that you have to deal with as a judge and your employees have to deal with. You've been bringing attention to this issue, so take us through exactly what you've been witnessing.
Yeah, it's certainly obvious to the people who work at the courthouse and who use the courthouse. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, part of the problem is where we're located on 3rd Avenue is we are in many respects surrounded by people in crisis. You have the downtown emergency shelter right across the street, and you have other shelters who are nearby. The ripple effect is impacting jurors, it can impact employees, it can impact members of the public, and whether that's having to step over feces to get into the courthouse, being assaulted, being harassed, exposed to, and like, these are experiences that people who are coming in and out of the courthouse doors are facing.
And something that happened, I believe, a year and a half ago, the former sheriff was actually attacked by someone who had a knife. He narrowly escaped getting stabbed. So in your position, why are you calling attention to this? Because some might say that going out in public will then make you maybe a little bit less impartial as a judge who might have to deal in situations where a homeless person's accused of something.
Yeah, well, this isn't an issue that I can say is caused by homelessness. What I can say, though, is that the impact of these issues that surround the courthouse can affect the administration of justice. And that's why I'm speaking out. I mean, we've had jurors who have, while they're in the midst of deliberations or on their lunch break, yelled at, mm-hmm. chased up the street, and then we ask them to come back and sit and make a decision that can affect someone's life, it can affect their business, or both. And this is a consequence of what's happening outside the courthouse doors. Now, as a judge, obviously I don't run the police department. I'm not on the city council. I'm not the mayor. And I don't write checks. But drawing some attention to this, I think, is important because of those other issues or those other impacts I've shared with you.
When did you start noticing things getting especially bad?
Well, this is going to be a little crass, but it was probably 2 years ago where I noticed that a local business had put up a sign right outside their door, mm-hmm. and it was a no pooping cam.
Jeez.
And they had to post it there to discourage mm-hmm. people. They put a camera up so they could capture it, but they had to discourage people from using their stairwell as toilet. I've worked down here at the courthouse coming on 19 years. I started out as a prosecutor working down here and then became a judge. And where we are now, probably in the last 3-4 years, it really is at its worst.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned the last 3 or 4 years, because I have a blog up right now, ktth.com, for those who want to read it. Seattle Times columnist Gene Balk yesterday said, you know, things aren't that bad in Seattle, and he goes back into the 80s to point to criminal rates. And yeah, the conversation isn't about comparing what's happening now to the 1980s. It's comparing now to just a few years ago. And I wonder, from your perspective, as we're having this conversation of whether or not Seattle is dying, which, yes, I'm assuming they admit over at Como that's a little bit of a hyperbole, but it's meant to capture the real emotional reaction to what the city is becoming, just to your point, in the last 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, well, as I said, I've worked down here for many years, and the circumstances on the streets outside the courthouse that impact the administration of justice mm-hmm. are some of the most acute. Now, I'll share you another statistic, if you will, with you and your readers.
Yeah.
You know, reader, listeners, excuse me. But one of the things that we've seen over the last 10 years, for example, there are filings in court involving people who are involuntarily committed for hospitalization because they present an acute danger to themselves, they present an acute danger to others. And in the last 10 years, I just was pulling the stats, our filings in Superior Court for those types of cases were under 2,500 cases a year, so 2,500 cases a year. Just in 2018, our filings were almost 5,000 wow. a year, up nearly 4% from the year prior. And it's the highest volume we're seeing for these cases where people present with acute mental illness and the like in the last 10 years. And we, as I said, we've just sort of seen those numbers double.
Just joining me, I'm talking on the line with King County Superior Court Judge Sean O'Donnell about the problems that are really plaguing downtown Seattle and Seattle in general. And I'm wondering, given the stat you just provided, what role do you think the court system is playing in the situation that's unfolding on the streets of Seattle? Because I know you can't get into specific cases, but we've certainly seen this list of prolific offenders and whatnot.
Yeah.
From
mm-hmm.
from your perspective, what's going on exactly?
Well, is. I mean, so for example, I'm the chief criminal judge for King County. And when I make a release decision, I have a legal framework that I have to operate under. It's a legal framework that flows from our Constitution, and it's a legal framework that flows from the text of the court rules that I'm compelled to follow. And I'll give you an example of that. If you are accused of a crime in King County, and a felony crime, and you come to Superior Court, the presumption is flowing from the presumption of innocence. And from our court rules, the presumption is you'll be released. That's what the text says of the rule. And I got to follow that text. I can't read beyond it. I have to use restraint in its application because that's my job as a judge. Now, that presumption can be overcome, again, by the text of the rule in three limited circumstances. I have to either find the person presents a substantial danger of committing a future act of violence. I have to find that they're not likely to show up to court,
mm-hmm.
or I have to find that they will interfere, it's a looser phrase, interfere with the administration of justice. Specifically, they're going to tamper with witnesses, destroy evidence, or violate a no-contact order or not follow my orders in some other ways. And even if I make one of those findings, the rule still requires me to look for ways to keep someone who is legally innocent out of custody. The last resort that I can apply is bail. And sometimes that's misunderstood, you know, how these decisions are made by a judge facing a release call. You know, my morning can be spent, I can have between 30 and 40 cases on mm-hmm. in a morning where I'm being asked to make release decisions in a very brief period of time with very limited information. And those are the toughest calls
sure.
for judges to make. And those are the ones I take home at night.
But if you could
think about them.
If you can put in perspective then, let's say in this hypothetical scenario in which I am accused of an assault and I stand in front of you and I have the presumption of innocence and the presumption that I will not be held. If you look into my background and I've done this three other times, what role does that play in how you view me in that one instance? What is the situation?
Well, yeah, I'm going to give you what you're going to say is a lawyerly answer, but it depends. Right? I mean, it depends. Are your past assaults from when you were 12 years old and you shoved your mom? And you're now 30 years old and you got into an altercation, what were the circumstances? And all of that, as I said, in this brief period of time, I am trying to synthesize mm-hmm. very quickly and then get out the crystal ball and make the prediction, are you likely to commit a future act of violence? Now, one thing the rule doesn't address It doesn't say if you are a prolific property offender, you can be detained.
Correct.
That's not in the rule. The rule passed by the Supreme Court is limited to committing future acts of violence, not showing up to court, or interfering with the administration of justice. It's in those circumstances that someone can be held. Because, I go back to this notion that we all embrace, the presumption of innocence. So, accusations sometimes don't meet the standard.
Of course. And that's standard, yeah.
Yeah, so that's sort of, if you want to dive into the policy behind it, that's the policy behind this rule, is if you are only accused and not convicted, you're in a very different posture than if a jury has come back and found you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Then my last question for you, Judge, is what can be done to at least mitigate some of these issues?
Well, you're not going to be happy with my answer on this one. That one really is outside my lane of expertise.
Sure, but you are bringing attention to this issue. So,
I sure am.
In a perfect world, then, how do you want people to respond to the photos that you place on Twitter of the stuff that's happening outside?
Yeah.
How do you want the city to respond to the fact that jurors might tell you, hey, I don't feel comfortable coming to the courthouse?
Yeah, so there are people in positions of power that are equipped to deal with this problem. Because of my position as a member of the judiciary, that's not me. And as I said, that's sort of probably a frustrating response. You become a judge and your First Amendment rights are limited. So I can't answer that question other than to say there are folks who do have the capacity to address this, who live in our city, run our city, run our county, live in our county. And I guess I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, then I'm going to cheat and ask you one real final question. If someone gets a summons to be on the jury, if you're told by this individual that they don't feel safe coming to the courthouse, do you dismiss them or do you say, no, too bad, you got to come and serve on a jury?
So I had that conversation with a juror just last week who wrote in and said those things, and I called him up and we walked through it. There are, sort of common sense approaches that people can take to get down to court. Know your surroundings. You know, be mindful of who's around you and where you are. And just be cognizant of what's going on around you. We have marshals at our entrances, at every entrance, and when jurors come in, they work with our jury staff to talk about areas that they can go on breaks and the like.
It's a sad commentary that you have to give that kind of advice to people, but it's the situation that we're dealing with right now.
It is, and I'll just say this about our jurors. They are the best. They are fulfilling their civic duty. They are. No, they really are. They're coming down. They're doing their civic duty. And without jurors, this system doesn't work. So we need them.
I would love to be on a jury, but I feel like my profession would immediately get me dismissed from a jury.
You never know.
Fingers crossed. I've yet to get a summons in the last 11 years. I've never gotten a single summons. But I'm looking forward to it. I've been talking with King County Superior Court Judge Sean O'Donnell. Judge O'Donnell, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Hey, anytime, Jason. Nice to talk with you.
Absolutely. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. We told you earlier about the U.S. attorney who is representing this region, Brian Moran. He's actually going to be on the show, hopefully, next week. He has said very clearly, do not go down the route of heroin injection sites in the city of Seattle. Don't do it. They will sue. Well, the mayor of Seattle, Jenny Durkin, she used to be in the exact same position that Brian Moran is in. But now that she's a mayor, now that she can be political, she's speaking up because she doesn't want to have to follow the law. She doesn't like the law, so she doesn't want to have to follow it. Not too long ago, she spoke to our sister station, Kyle Radio's Aaron Granillo, before they pulled her away from actually finishing the answer. But she got into her response to this news that she's not going to be able to go forward with her heroin injection site.
I think that we need to have more public health response to the opioid addiction crisis. And when we had the task force come together, they made a range of recommendations. And it's not just the chels or the injection sites. The important things about them are they connect people with the ability to get treatment, a public health option, Narcan so you don't have overdoses. We have to try a whole bunch of tools in order to have a harm reduction model instead of a punitive model. I was very disappointed that the Department of Justice filed its lawsuit against Philadelphia trying to stop them, and that yesterday they made clear they try to stop us. I would rather them focus their efforts on trying to stop the flow of opioids and let us deal with the public health part.
But just real quickly, I'll let her finish. You're not dealing with the public health part. You're not dealing with the public health part because you're not allowing us to really fully invest in treatment on demand. Telling me you care about this issue by enabling people to continue their addiction doesn't give me the sense that you want to fight the harder fight, which is getting people clean, right? Because that's a hard fight. There's no doubt about that. And part of the reason why so many politicians don't want to go down that route is because they're going to lose before they win. They don't like to lose. They like to push these ideological positions. This is, to be clear, an ideological position. Heroin injection sites is driven by progressive ideologues because they think that this is the more compassionate way. Well, we're not going to force them to get treatment. You don't want to force them to. Let's let them continue to go down the path of addiction and get them to be even more reliant on us, the government.
Got to be part of a range of solutions. But I also take their threat very seriously. We have to take it seriously. So I'll be talking to council and community to see what the next path forward is. Pete Holmes and I, who's the city attorney, we've talked about, you know, we are already an amicus in the lawsuit in Philadelphia. And there may be some alternatives available here for us.
Yeah, alternatives, like ignoring. This is, by the way, when they pulled her away. Ignoring the law, that's the alternative. You can follow the law or you can ignore it. There's no in between. You're a mayor who used to be in the exact same position as this U.S. attorney, and you're now taking a position that you don't want to follow laws. And so, whatever, we're just going to do it anyway. That's pretty disturbing. It's pretty disturbing because there's no information whatsoever, no data whatsoever to suggest this actually gets people off of heroin. Should that not be our main goal? And you heard her at the beginning of that clip say this is about harm reduction. You know what also reduces harm? Treatment. You know what doesn't? Enabling. There's no data that suggests people who engage in heroin injection sites actually get off the heroin ever. There's no meaningful data. There's no meaningful results, no positive results. And if there were, she would lead every single conversation she has about this topic with, we're doing heroin injection sites because we've seen a 32% rate in positive results getting off of heroin. She doesn't use that stat because it doesn't exist. And so instead, they change the conversation. This is about coddling dangerous behavior. Dangerous behavior that is going to lead to these individuals' death. And I guess they're okay with it. I'm not. I'm not okay with it. I'm not okay with people dying of their heroin addiction. I want to get them treatment. And any solution has to start and end with treatment on demand. That's our moral obligation. It's unfortunate the mayor doesn't agree. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really, really appreciate it. Don't forget, download the app. Text the keyword app to 1-800-465-8770. Up next, Ben Shapiro.